Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here. As always, I want to welcome you all to our teleconference. We just are fresh off a really great and successful, it was a magnificent course that we had in Baltimore this past week, and it had a great crowd, and it really was well received. So all of you who were there, I want to thank you so much for joining and for being such wonderful active participants. The feedback that we got from you folks in the evaluation was really unbelievable. So thank you so much. It's really appreciated. Now, for our teleseminar tonight, even up until October, November, we get people joining us for the first time. So how this works for our newcomers, we have two people today who have got in touch with the office saying they had some interesting case or two that they wanted to present, and they've sent in their cases. I read them shortly before this, before signing on, and outside of knowing what the cases are, it's totally unscripted. We'll see where the conversation takes us. Having briefly read through the cases that were presented, these are, I assure you, as is 99% of the time, highly exam relevant. So it's really good for everyone listening in. So with that out the way, let's see if our two volunteers are with us. The first one is Mayor. Mayor, are you there, Mayor?
Yes, I'm here.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Meher.
Meher. Okay, fine. Meher. Okay, thank you and welcome. Thank you for joining. And then our second volunteer, Alex. Alex, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. Welcome and thank you too. So, folks, to all intents and purposes, we're done with cases construction. There are a few of you that still have taken the ABOG deadline, so you still have your cases in front of you, and I'm guessing that Meher and Alex are two such people, and that's fine. I do want to share with you, though, I could say it at the end of the session, but I'll do it now. Once you send in your cases, whether you've done it already or whether you still need to do it, I do believe strongly that you should take about a 3, maybe 4-day guilt-free exam-free holiday. Forget about studying. Forget about the exam. Just clear your mind. Relax. Rest up. Be yourself. Be a parent. Be a sibling. Not a sibling, a spouse. Just enjoy life and forget about the exam for a couple of days. You'll be in a much better position when you then pick up thereafter. So, with that being said, I'm still going to, this will be the last time, I'm still going to talk about caseless and construction issues potentially, but we're also going to be talking about caseless review now, because even if you've handed in your cases, you still need to review what you've got on that list and make sure you can handle all the questions that are likely to arise. And then we'll shift imperceptibly into oral exam technique issues. So, Meher, let's start with you. You've got two cases. Let's take the first one. Go ahead and present it very succinctly, and we'll talk.
Okay. Is the first one the surgical case with the
CIN3, the CIN3 colon cone?
Okay. So this is okay. I'm trying to look for the case.
If you want to start with the other case in the interest of time, that's also fine, whatever you prefer.
Okay, I will be ready in just 1 second. Okay, this was a 39-year-old Gravita 1, Para 1. She came in with postcoital bleeding. On exam, there was a small cervical lesion. I did a colposcopy and biopsy that showed CIN3. So I took her back for a cold knife cone, and endocervical curettage. The cold knife cone showed invasive squamous cell carcinoma with all margins positive, and the ECC was also positive. This patient ended up having a delayed hemorrhage, likely from the leftover cancer. The first time I took her back, I had discussed this case with the oncologist prior to doing her cone, and then subsequently after I got the diagnosis. And so when I took her back about a week later, I discussed the case with him, but he was not available in the hospital at that time. I did a Strondorf suture to obtain hemostasis, and then she bled again, and this time I took her back with the oncologist, who, again, reinforced some of the suturing and then eventually did a urine artery embolization after transfusing her and stabilizing her.
So this is a great case. There are a couple of issues that come up. Now, first of all, every single one of you listening in, all of you have to be able to describe the pros and cons of a LEAP versus a cold knife cone. Now, I've got one criticism for you, Mayor, and this is important for everyone listening in. You described it as a 39-year-old para 1 grav 1. The question is, and you should always mention it, because it has the potential, not necessarily in this case, but in 99% of cases, to affect management. And the issue you never mentioned was her desired fertility. At 39, para 1, she may still be desirous of more children. And when you go in with a pre-op diagnosis of CIN3, that can affect your decision-making. So I want to emphasize to you, Maher, and everyone listening in, and this is clearly peri- or postmenopausal, it's important in these kind of cases to speak about fertility desires, okay?
Okay.
Now, you started off with a pre-op diagnosis in CIN3.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up with invasive carcinoma.
Yes.
So there's a pre- and post-op diagnosis discrepancy.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that's one of the issues you're concerned about. Am I correct?
Yes, that the invasive carcinoma, yes.
Yeah. So I want to impress upon everyone listening in, you've got to make sure that your pre- and post-op diagnoses are the same. And if they're not the same, or there's a surprise finding, you must be able to speak to it, okay? So in this case, you've got to be able to explain how come the colposcopically directed biopsy got it so wrong, number one. And it may not be so wrong. It might be just bad luck, okay? But this is where the conversation goes. There's another thing, Mahara, that you didn't mention that's very important. And that is, I'm guessing that there are isolated tongues of epithelium that have penetrated the basement membrane. I could be wrong. But there's a big issue to state how deep do those tongues penetrate below the basement membrane. Because it makes a difference between, and I've got to remember it, stage 1A1 and 1A2. If it's more than 3 millimeters depth of penetration, is my understanding, it's no longer a 1A1, it's now a 1A2. So do you know what the depth of penetration was?
So our colposcopy biopsy forceps are probably about one to two centimeters deep. They're not very deep.
No, you mean millimeters. The copper biopsy is measured in millimeters. But I'm talking about your cone specimen. That would have been a much bigger.
My cone specimen was very deep.
No, but on the cone specimen, what did the pathologist say? How deep were those? Was the malignancy extending below the basement membrane? Now, folks, just look at what's going on here. This is a conversation. I know every one of you are getting, you know, cold shivers down your spine, thinking, "Oh my goodness, do we got to know this level of histology?" And the answer for most of you is not really critical. Although this particular issue we're discussing, it's nice to know. But for Meher, she has to know that. By the time she walks into the exam, she will know this. So again, Meher, my question to you on the cone specimen, what was the depth of penetration of the malignancy? Do you know offhand?
I do not know that answer.
Okay.
I don't think they even mentioned it. They basically wrote invasive squamous cell carcinoma, all margins positive. Like, it was just extensive. And
so, you know, unless
that, to the basement membrane. I hear you.
Unless they've changed the staging. And I could be wrong on this, but that 3 millimeter depth,
yes,
distinguishes stage 1A1 from 1A2. And
mm-hmm.
The difference between 1A1 and 1A2 is the difference between if pregnancy is desired, a simple hysterectomy versus a radical hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very important distinction. And in a case like this, I feel so strongly about it. And if you folks have this kind of situation on your cases, you need to go and pick up the phone and phone the pathologist, even if they have to look at the slides again. Because I would guess that the gen oncologist wants to know, unless he's looked at the slides him or herself, I don't know. But you know, if they're going to be conservative and just try and get away with a simple hysterectomy, you've got to make sure it's not more than 3 millimeters depth of penetration. That's the point I want to make.
So when I did the when I went back with the gynecologist oncologist, he said that there was perimetral lesion on its exam, and so it was like 2 millimeters.
Hold on. Did he say perimetral invasion? I didn't hear you. What did you say?
Yeah. So when I
oh okay back, so then this is okay if there's parametrial invasion, this
yeah,
is a stage two or
like
three. This is not 1A1, 1A2. Okay,
no,
all right. So you see, yeah, it goes way up the stage in protocol. This is probably a stage 2B, I'm guessing. 3B is when it hits the sidewall. So it's maximum a 3A. It might be a 2B, but.
This is chemo and radiation after the.
Yeah, that makes sense. She would get chemo as a. She would get radiation primarily and adjunctive chemo instead of surgery as the primary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, you see, it's important to mention these things because in mentioning them, the conversation changes. You know, we were debating 1A1 versus 1A2. The moment she mentioned the word parametrial, that changes the conversation. So you've got to think about your case. Think about how you're going to present it. And as best as you can, work out what the questions might be. And Meher, I think you saw how my question changed dramatically after you said parametrial.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that? Okay.
So I already submitted my list. I didn't put the stage on there, the final stage.
That's okay. All it means is you must add it verbally. Just give it over verbally, the details of what we're discussing.
Okay.
And folks, all of you, I'm telling you, because I've reviewed I can't tell you how many cases over my career. All of you between now, having just handed in your case list and taking the exam, you're going to find mistakes. I'm just telling you, you're going to find errors and you're going to get freaked out. And 99 times out of 100, there's no need. It's just a simple clarification which is now made verbally. It is incredibly rare where the error is majorly problematic. Let me go off at a tangent for just a moment. Like I said, virtually all of you are going to find these kind of errors. Some of them might be simple typographic errors. If the error, you've got to look at the error and say to yourself, does this error, whatever it is, does it have medical consequence or not? If it doesn't have medical consequence, it's not an issue. But if it has medical consequence, you've got to be able to speak to it. Now, just by the way, if you find a mistake, your P's and G's are reversed, and your P's are, you've got a gravida 2 para 3, that's obviously, unless she's had twins, for example, that's obviously a problem. And although although it's obviously a typographical error, it may still prompt a question such as, well, I see you got the P's and G's wrong. I'm sure it was just a switch. And you'll say, absolutely fine. But then they'll say, well, tell me something. What define parity and gravita for me? So you might have an innocuous typographical error, but it may prompt a question nevertheless. So just be aware of that. That's all I'm saying, okay? All right. So, Meher, you've got to just be able to speak to the issue and mention that it was parametrial. Now, did you do – it's actually important for Meher. You need to know the staging of CF cervix, okay? And as best as I know, CA cervix is a clinical staging confirmed with IVP, says lateral wall extension, and cystoscopy, and say again?
They changed it so we can actually use CT now as of
Okay. Okay. Fine. I'm not going to stick to that. I'm totally comfortable to accept that. My question is, this wasn't a pre-post-op diagnosis discrepancy of CIN3 versus microinvasive carcinoma. This was CIN3 versus probably stage 2 A or B mm-hmm. carcinoma.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how come you missed it? How come you missed it? That's the question. So how would you – folks – whenever you folks call me with a concern, I just pose the exact question that you worried about to you, and you've got to be able to address it. So, Meher, give it a shot. What are you going to say?
Okay. So when I did her exam initially, I was concerned for cancer, and I counseled her as such. She had gone about 8 years without having a pap smear. But I still did a colposcopic biopsy first as the next step because I didn't have a diagnosis yet. I was surprised that the biopsy.
What was there a macroscopic lesion? Sorry, Meher. Was there a macroscopic lesion or not?
There was visually abnormal areas on the cervix without the colposcope.
Okay, here's a crappy question, but it's very fair.
Yeah.
Why do we do colposcopy?
To look for microscopy.
And it's relevant in this case. Mm-hmm. Why do we do colposcopy?
To look for microscopic abnormal areas that could be precancerous or cancer.
Correct. To look for microscopic areas, which are the worst areas where we want a biopsy, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
you saw something macroscopically.
Yes, and I did biopsy that area, but I also looked microscopically to look for any other areas.
Okay, so I love that answer. I love that answer. That's perfect. But just be aware, to everyone listening, if you see a lesion, there's an argument to be made, why do the colposcope? Just biopsy it. But you can make that argument because you want to see the extent of the background disease, for example. Okay, so you did your biopsy.
I haven't quite defended it yet. So essentially,
okay, go ahead,
After speaking with the oncologist, later on, so I spoke with him prior to doing the procedure. At that time, he was in complete agreement that I should go ahead with the cold knife cone. But after I had the complication and I had him go back with me, he was like, oh, this was essentially that the biopsy wasn't deep enough to diagnose the cancer. That's why it's
So it's odd because the cancer begins at the squamous columnar junction, which is on the surface. So unless it was an incomplete, inadequate colposcopy where you couldn't visualize the entire squamous columnar junction, it's just odd that that comment would be made. But I'm a generalist. I'm not going to argue with a general oncologist.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was something I learned that day.
Okay. Look, in the exam, you said this is what the oncologist said, and I've got to be honest. I found it surprising for the following reason, but the oncologist has much more experience than I in this area, and so I bowed to his or her superior knowledge. And you say that's totally fine. And if the specialist gets it wrong, and he or she didn't in this case, but even if they get it wrong, it's okay to bow to their superior knowledge. We expect it to be right, but it won't be right all the time. But I want you to be comfortable to say these words in the exam, okay?
Okay.
All right. Did you consider doing a Lugol's iodine test?
I always do both acetic acid and Lugol's iodine.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. Look, we've actually discussed the bulk of this issue, of this case. It all stems from the fact that you've got a pre- and post-op diagnosis discrepancy. And the fact that you've got the discrepancy is okay. For those listening in, if you've got the discrepancy, that really is okay. As long as you can speak to it, that's all. Meher, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
It was a pretty big discrepancy because of the staging, as you discussed, like the parametrial. Mm-hmm. So they're going to ask me, well, did you do an exam to
EUA
for parametrial invasion? And
did you do a CT preoperatively or not? I guess before the cone you didn't. There was no indication.
No, I did not.
Now, just by the way, if you had have done, and folks, this is a lesson for all of you listening in. If Meher had done a CT scan before she did the cone, that would have been poor management because it was unindicated, and they would appropriately accuse her of overutilization of resources. As it turns out, it would have helped the patient in this particular case, but it's not the recommended way to go if all you're suspecting is CIN3. So you can do whatever you want as long as you can explain it, okay?
Okay.
I just got one more question, and now I understand. Because in your email to me, you said there was a blood transfusion required after with delayed hemorrhage.
Mm-hmm.
Now you cut into a cancer is what happened. Okay. So that can be explained, but I just want you to be aware that I can give you a structured case on this issue. The absolutely classical description, and the word they use is delayed. Delayed hemorrhage following on a leap or a cold knife cone is you get delayed hemorrhage after you use Petresin to try and stem bleeding. So I was wondering whether you use Petresin. And so if you've got Petresin, if you've got delayed bleeding in the context of a cold knife cone or a leap, be prepared for one sentence discussion on Petresin, okay?
Petresin, okay.
All right.
How long
now,
after does it cause the hemorrhage?
I believe it wears off after about 6 hours, something of that nature. Okay.
Okay.
And yeah, it's just enough for them to get home and when they start bleeding again, and they have to come back. The rest of the management here is fine. I'm not worried about it. Are you okay with this case now, Meher?
Yes, I guess. Yes.
Okay. Listen, if you still have any concerns, I don't want to belabor the point too much now, but get in
mm-hmm.
touch with me and we can chat more about it over the phone if you want, okay?
Okay.
All right. Meher, before we go to your second case, I'm going to let Alex present his case. And
okay.
then we'll come back to your second case. So, Alex, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So I had a patient who presented to me. She was a 37-year-old G6P4 with a history of chronic pelvic pain and a prior hysterectomy for abnormal uterine bleeding and pelvic pain where endometriosis is noted. Discussed management options for her. She had previously failed medical management and declined any further medical management. So we discussed a bilateral salpingophorectomy for her treatment.
How old did you say she was? Sorry, I missed that. How old?
She's 37.
37, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, 37 mm-hmm. years old. So I took her back. We did the diagnostic laparoscopy. I did note endometriosis on laparoscopy, and we moved forward with the laparoscopic BSO. I guess my concern for her is just, you know, weighing surgical menopause versus, you know, chronic pelvic pain. She did mention a history of what she called mini strokes. So I was really, you know, I was really hesitant to put her on hormone replacement afterwards. And we had previously discussed that before we even went into surgery, that she may not be a good candidate for hormone replacement.
Okay, so go ahead. Sorry, I'm interrupting. Carry on.
Yeah, no, so, I mean, I saw her post-op. She's satisfied with treatment, no longer having pelvic pain, but, you know, she did present with some hot flashes. So I put her on the Neurokinin 3 antagonist of Veozah, and that's been taking care of her hot flashes pretty well. So,
okay, so look, this is a case on your GYN list, not on your office list. So
right.
They're not going to get into the treatment of premature menopause, surgical menopause, and hot flashes. That's not what
mm-hmm.
they're going to talk about. What they are going to talk about is the management of chronic pelvic pain, which you've already exhausted already, and now you've got your back against the wall, contemplating a BSNO on a 37-year-old. You know, a lot of you listening in have bilateral oophorectomies on patients under 55. How much more so is it, and I'm going to use a harsh word, Alex, but how much more egregious is it in a 37-year-old? Now, it's not fair to use the word egregious because it's potentially appropriate. The whole defense on this kind of a case, and a lot of you have something similar, the whole defense of whipping out the ovaries on a 37-year-old, it's all down to counseling. And you've got to be able to show how you counseled her, and you want to embellish slightly the concerns of young age oophorectomy. And minimize slightly the benefits of being free of chronic pelvic pain. You want to show you're trying to conserve those ovaries in the way you counsel. But you can't be dishonest, but just, you know, just sway it slightly in one direction in favor of conserving the ovaries. And a lot of you have a case like this, chronic pelvic pain, in which, let's say, the patient's 50, 45 years old, in which you consider moving the ovaries. It's imperative when you discuss your counseling that as part of the counseling you add that the patient understood that you could not guarantee that the pain would resolve even with both ovaries gone. I mean, the chances are very good it will, but you can't give that guarantee. It's important to state that, okay? So, you know, this is a tragic case, and you've got to embellish all the reasons why we try to avoid doing a bilateral oophorectomy in such a young age woman. And don't forget osteoporosis, DEXA scans, and dietary consequences for this woman, and lifetime all causes of death. Her life expectancy could be reduced slightly. You've got to mention all these negatives of removing the ovary in such a young patient. And at the end of the day, you say, you know, I counseled the patient. She understood the risks and the benefits, and she was comfortable to go ahead with the procedure. You might also want to add, I got a second opinion. I got a psychiatric evaluation. Maybe she's got repressed memories of spousal abuse, rape, childhood abuse. Can be all of these things. You might want to say, I mean, now it's too late, but if it's possible, you could say, you know, I even got a center for an evaluation for musculoskeletal causes for this pain, and everything turned out negative. So just be as conservative as possible. Alex, let me ask you a question, and I'm not trying to tout for work here. Please don't be shy to say no. Did you come yet, or are you still planning on coming to our Definitive Oral Prep course?
I chose to do the online course.
Okay, that's fine. Because you may have watched it or not yet, there's a section on which we discuss removing ovaries and a uterus in a young age patient, and that's important for you, obviously, as well as
yes.
anyone else listening in. Look, this case is really straightforward. It all comes down to counseling for bilateral oophorectomy, and it's nothing more than that. It's simple and straightforward. Be open and honest in the way you present your counseling. And it's fine. It's a nice case because it allows you to shine in showing the examiner how you exhausted all conservative options of therapy. And you told her, you know, when you talk about counseling, risks, benefits, alternatives, you're showing the examiner you understand the issues involved in this pathology. And it really gives you an opportunity to shine. And you must say, this at the end of the day, this was a tragic case because a 37-year-old lost her ovaries. That speaks volumes. And I encourage you to say it in those many words. Okay, Alex? So
yes.
I actually think this is pretty straightforward. Do you have any questions still, or are you comfortable, or no?
No, I'm guessing. I understand it's on my GYN list. Is there a way that they could ultimately ask, you know, whether I put the patient on hormone therapy or not, given that I removed her ovaries?
Yes. And it'll be one sentence, one answer, you know, one sentence answer, and you move on. They're not going to go into the details. And you can say, you know, I would have liked to have given her X, but because of her past medical history, I gave her Y. And she's actually done very well. And that's it. That's the extent of it.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So are you okay? Any other questions?
So whenever I type, the way I typed up the case, is that okay in the diagnosis and preoperative column there?
I would just say, you know, I like to be bold, and I like to entice the examiner to ask me certain questions. So I would put in the treatment column where you put BSNO, put an exclamation mark behind that, or two,
okay.
or three, because then the exam, you can say, you know, you notice I put an exclamation mark because this is really an unusual case. I don't typically do this, and then you go into your discussion.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. It's a nice case. Just be prepared for it. That's all. All right. Very good. Meher, let's come back to you. You there, Meher?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, great. You've got a second case. Go. Oh, hold a sec. Alex, did you also have a second case? Yeah, you also got a question about cord blood gases, yes? Okay.
Correct.
Let's do this case with Meher, and then I'll come back to your cord blood gas. Because it's actually, this issue came up in our course in Baltimore last week, and we'll discuss it again now with you. But Meher, go ahead and present your case quickly, your second case.
Okay. This is a 38-year-old Gravida 3 Para 1. She presented at 10 centimeters dilation at 23 weeks and 1 day. She had very complicated history with type 2 diabetes, end-stage renal disease, coronary artery disease with a myocardial infarction in 2023, and chronic hypertension. When she had started prenatal care with one of my partners, they had transferred her out to a higher level of care due to the number of comorbidities that the patient had. She had established care at the other hospital, but then presented in preterm labor here. She was already 10 centimeters dilated. She was about to deliver, but then it was revealed that she had a history of a classical caesarean section, and a patient chose to have a C-section.
Let me stop you there just for 1 second.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and Alex, feel free to pipe in here. But I believe in the most recent ACOG publication on TOLAC and VBAC,
mm-hmm.
they say that if you've got a patient who's had a previous classical C-section, if you get her when she's fully dilated, you should let her deliver, because most of the risk of rupture is in dilating up the cervix and not necessarily delivering. So I believe if you, like your patient, presents at full dilatation, you can let her labor. Am I correct? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes, so I had counseled her because when I had read it, and I read it right before I went in to talk to her, it mm-hmm. said that, you know, in those cases, it's dependent on the physician and shared decision with the patient. And because mm-hmm. she wanted full resuscitation for the 23-week fetus that was going to be delivered, she opted to have a cesarean section despite me counseling her on the risks to her with the cesarean section and the recommendation to continue with the delivery. We had very emergency.
Okay, and by the way, let me add one extra issue.
Mm-hmm.
Any of you who have patients, and a lot of you do, with multiple comorbidities, such as, and this patient has multiple severe comorbidities, mm-hmm. you've got to be able to pass opinion. What's the best way to deliver her from an anesthesia point of view? And what would your answer be, Meher?
I think that the lowest risk for her would have been to have a vaginal delivery.
Okay.
Anesthesia-wise,
what's the best way? Did she have a general anesthetic?
Sure.
Did she have a general?
No, she actually received the spinal and then ended up getting intubated with general later because she was still feeling.
Yeah, because you want to avoid a GA. You want to give regional. That's the best anesthesia
okay.
for a patient like this. Yeah. Okay. Look, have you handed in your case list already or not yet?
Yes, it's done.
Okay. So look, she had these major issues.
Mm-hmm.
She has a delivery at 23 and 1 day, the cusp
mm-hmm.
of viability.
Mm-hmm.
There was ACLS on this patient. Number one, you don't need to be able to run a code for the OB board exam. Just remember A, B, C, D, you know, airway breathing, you know, cardiovascular drugs, etc. Just know that that's more important than anything, okay? But you don't need to be able to run a code. What's the, from the exam point of view, and a lot of you have this, this is really important now what I'm going to go into. If you've got a patient on the cusp of viability, how do you counsel them regarding neonatal infantile viability? What kind of a prognosis does the offspring have? And how do you counsel a patient in this regard? That's number one. Number two, are you going to monitor the baby or not? Because if she says she doesn't want active management, don't monitor the baby. Because the ultimate question they will ask you is, will you do a, on a 23-weeker, will you do a C-section for fetal indications? And if the answer is no, then don't monitor. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's your case. It's be able to list the neonatal complications of severe prematurity. And all this this medical stuff is really relevant. This is, when you sift through all of it, cardiac arrest, this is not a, it's not a, an ER trauma exam. This is OB.
Okay.
This is going to be just a discussion on management of a patient that presents in labor, previous C-section. She was previously, at 23 weeks. And how did you count? How would you counsel if you had the chance to do so? And how did you manage? That may get a touch into magnesium sulfate. She was too late for tocolytics, but they could ask you a little bit about tocolytics. The rest, it's pretty straightforward. I wouldn't worry about that, okay? Are you all right with that case then?
Okay, so they're not going to ask me about, yeah, this was my thing, is like, what questions are they going to ask on this case, because the amount that I need to be prepared for it. I know that there's risk of cardiac complications with patients with a history of cardiac disease is in the third stage of labor, which is actually when she coded. And
correct. And you've got to be able to explain why. I forgot. I'm so pleased you brought this up.
Yeah.
You've got to know, now, not everyone listening in, okay? But Meher, you need to know the cardiovascular changes that occur in normal pregnancy. And classically, these people go into failure in the third stage of labor, because that uterus, which used to be so big, is now so much smaller, and all the blood that used to traverse through that uterus now is forced into the systemic and the pulmonary circulation, and it overloads them, and they go into failure. So that is classical. And there was one other thing that I wanted to say. Oh my dear, what was it? Yes, and I had to look this up, because at the course in Baltimore last week, I had this conversation, and a candidate told me something which was different to what I knew, and I was quoting out-of-date information, and they were quoting more up-to-date information. Yeah, and here's the question. What happens if she codes, and you're trying to save the baby? It's a perimortem C-section. How long do you have? She codes. What do?
You resuscitate her.
You code the mother first? You section her first? What do?
You code the mother first, and then at 4 minutes, you cut the baby out to return blood flow to the mom to help resuscitate.
And then get the baby out, close up, and then carry on with the mom. So some authorities talk of the four-minute rule. Some talk of the five-minute rule. They say, by the fifth minute, you should be making your incision. Okay.
Okay.
So
just be aware of that. I was cut to 4 minutes because you wanted the baby out by 5 minutes.
So it depends who you read. Okay. They're not going to quibble over 4 versus 5. It's absolutely
okay.
Fine either way. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Very nice. Nice case, Meher. You okay with that? Any questions? You okay?
Okay, they're not going to ask me about ACLS. I put hyperkalemia. Can they ask me about hyperkalemia and stuff?
What's the best way to get rid of hyperkalemia, I believe, is to give glucose and insulin. Isn't that, doesn't that send the potassium into the cells? You know, it's been so long since I did it. Am I right with that? I'm a generalist. I don't know these things.
I think she had developed hyperkalemia because I transfused her because she had a hemoglobin of 8, and I wanted her to make sure she was having a hemoglobin of greater than 8.
That's fine. They can ask you blood transfusion, absolutely. I don't think they're going to ask you more than one sentence worth of hyperkalemia. That's an MFM question, not a general board question.
Okay?
Any other questions
that you can come up with from here?
It's a vaginal delivery versus C-section. I should say the best way to deliver this person is assisted vaginal delivery versus C-section. It's preterm labor. You know, if you've got no diabetes or cardiac disease on your cases and hypertension in other patients, they may ask you that as well. Yeah. But I'm sure you've got those discussions waiting to happen in other patients.
Yeah.
So I don't think it'll happen on this case. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Very good, very good. Alex, let's go ahead quickly with your second question, and then we'll talk about it. Go ahead.
Right. So my second question was in regards to umbilical cord blood gases. I understand that, you know, they should be collected whenever you have a 5-minute Apgar score less than 5, or 5 or less, I mean. Which I had been doing. I had been collecting the actual umbilical cord and, you know, giving verbal orders for it. But so none of my other partners, I guess, collect them. So the nurses didn't really know what to do with the cord blood gases. And I just have, I guess, several cases where I don't have any cord blood gases to present.
Sorry, you already what? I didn't hear that. You already what?
What? So I brought this up to the nursing staff, and, you know, it's something that we're going to discuss at the OB committee meeting, how that, you know, it's necessary to do these. But since I have a couple of deliveries where the 5-minute Apgar score was less than 5, I don't have any, like, cord blood gases for them, despite me kind of ordering them.
This is very, very easy to handle. Just let me get a technical thing out the way. You say some of these babies, they were, I seem to understand, they were delivered by your partner and they didn't request the gases. So just technically, strictly speaking, if they're delivered by your partner, they don't have to appear on your list. So you don't have to include them.
That's not what I meant. What I meant was that my partners apparently don't collect umbilical cord blood gases.
I see. So the nurses are neither here nor there.
Right.
Okay, I understand.
So
okay.
This isn't what to do with them. And
so look, the way you defend this, Alex, is very easy. You just be blatantly open and honest. You say, you know, at the hospital where I work, some doctors request it and others don't. And as a consequence, there is a fair amount of confusion amongst the nursing staff. As a consequence of my preparing my cases and preparing for the exam, this came to my attention. And I'm actually in the midst of bringing this issue up at the practice meeting or the hospital departmental meeting, because ideally speaking, the recommendation is 1, 2, 3. So just phrase it exactly the way you told me, okay? Now, furthermore, from the exam point of view, for those of you that have handed in your case list already, and if you've put down cord gases, all I can say is you have my condolences. For the, and I'll come back to that in a minute. For those of you that have not yet handed in your case list yet, please don't put down the cord gases. Now, notice I said cord gases. I don't want you to put down the bicarb and the PCO2. Because if you do that, you're inviting a question on what is the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. How do you distinguish between metabolic versus respiratory acidosis or alkalosis? And most of us mere mortals don't want to go down that road. And MFM, that's fair game. But not at the general board level. So what I would say is, if you've got an APGAR at 5 minutes of five or less, sure, put down the pH. And if you feel compelled, put down the base excess. But don't put down anything more than that. You want to try and steer away from this conversation as much as possible. But in your case, Alex, have you handed in your case list or not yet?
Not yet, no.
Okay, so I would only put the pH maximum the base excess, and only on those cases five or less. And I would say on those cases where something that's valid is not present, I would typically say cord gases not available with an exclamation mark. But in this particular case, I would counsel you not to do that, because by putting down cord gases not available, it begs the question, why not? And then you find yourself getting involved in a cord gas conversation. And I'm guessing Alex, as well as many of you listening in, really would not be so comfortable getting involved in that conversation. So I would not recommend you put that down. Just leave it blank and that's it. If they ask you, how come some cases you've got it and other cases you don't? Then you go and be blatantly honest and you say exactly what you told me. Does that make sense to you, Alex?
Yeah, so I'm guessing just don't mention it.
Don't mention it. And if it comes up, then verbally you'll
right.
Hand it over. But I wouldn't try and encourage the conversation on paper. You know, if it happens to come up, then do it. Say again?
Would you recommend me putting in the 10-minute APGAR score?
So that's a very good point. I'm pleased you raised it. The committee opinion, which is fairly old, but I think it's still current, states it's entitled APGAR scores. And I believe it's if the 5 minute the 1 minute APGAR is virtually inconsequential. But if the 5 minute APGAR is five or less, you should continue with a 10-minute APGAR and continue 5 minutes, every 5 minutes, until the APGAR gets above five, six or higher. So, yes, I would recommend putting down the 10-minute APGAR if you have it.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. That's what I've
okay.
been doing. I have an APGAR on all of them since I don't have any pH or
yeah.
any – core blood gases.
Yeah, and you can explain it away. It's very easy. Yeah, it's all good. You're all good. All right, Alex, very good. Very nice cases. Folks, let me just make a few quick announcements. The next teleseminar, we usually do these every 2 weeks, but in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to be lecturing at our definitive board prep course in Los Angeles. I won't be able to do the session, but we will have a makeup teleseminar, which will be a week early, which means it's going to be next week on the 18th of August. And although I won't be available either on that day, many of you have met and worked with Dr. Lou Foley. I believe he's going to be conducting it. He's excellent. You'll find him very fantastic and very helpful. So I just want to share with you, the next one will be on the 18th, and then there's going to be a break. We would normally have one on the 25th, I think, which is two weeks. There's nothing on the 20th. After the bottom line, after next week, the next one will be the 8th of September. So there'll be a bit of a gap. It's because of scheduling issues. But the next one is not in 2 weeks' time. It's going to be in 1 week time. I just wanted to share that with you. All right, folks, that being said, if you are toying with the idea of coming to our Definitive Board Prep course, I want to encourage you to do that. We do have it available online, which you can view anytime you want, and it definitely is very convenient. There's no question about it. But if you can possibly make it to a live course, the level of learning is much better because there are no distractions at home. It's very difficult to sit in front of a computer for 4, 5, 6 days. So I would encourage you, if you can, if it doesn't make too much of a difference, come to the live course. It is preferred. All right, folks, that's it. Thanks to Alex. Thanks to Meher. And we'll do this again next week on August the 18th. Thanks once again, folks. All the best. Take care.
Thank you.